From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, The Great Escape with Chickens. We talk with Nick Park and Peter Lord about their new animated movie Chicken Run, a satire of prisoner of war films. Park is best known for his Academy Award-winning Wallace and Gromit animated shorts. Lord is the co-founder of the Aardman Clay Animation Studio. Also, TV critic David Bianculli reviews two popular British TV shows that have been imported to the U.S., and jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews Hollywood Swing and Jazz, a new collection of jazz performances from classic films. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Republicans in Congress continue to call on Energy Secretary Bill Richardson to resign. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
GOP lawmakers are angry over the disappearance and mysterious reappearance of two computer hard drives at the Los Alamos National Laboratory in New Mexico. The hard drives contained classified nuclear data. Richardson had promised to put in place new security procedures at Los Alamos after scientist Wen-Ho Lee was accused of downloading sensitive information onto a non-secure computer. Florida Republican Porter Goss, chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, stopped short of calling on Richardson to step down, but says it's time for a change at the Energy Department.
And I would suspect that if he thought about it rationally instead of defensively, he might come to the conclusion it was time for him to move on to something else and let somebody come in who could take a fresh look at this and bring in some new energy on it.
The White House calls the charges against Richardson cheap political pot shots. Brian Naylor, NPR News, the Capitol.
Opening statements are expected tomorrow in a wrongful death lawsuit filed against the federal government by survivors of the 1993 Branch Davidian siege. The members of the religious sect say government agents were partly to blame for the fiery end of the siege in Waco, Texas. More than 80 people, including many children, were killed when the Branch Davidian compound burned. The U.S. Supreme Court has ruled in a Texas case that public schools cannot let students lead crowds in prayer before high school football games. Bill Zeeble reports from member station KERA in Dallas.
The case stems from the Santa Fe Independent School District near Galveston. Hoping to avoid the constitutional separation of church and state, school officials knew they could not officially sanction prayer, so they let students elect a chaplain who would. But a Catholic and Mormon family objected after a prayer was led before a high school football game. The school policy was struck down by the U.S. Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals in New Orleans, and the school district appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court. In the 6-3 decision against the school district, Justice John Paul Stevens said when schools sponsor a religious message, it sends a signal to those not praying that they're outsiders and not full members of the community. For NPR News, I'm Bill Zeeble in Dallas.
Firefighters in Colorado are concerned that hot, dry, windy weather could hamper their efforts to control two major wildfires near Denver. The blazes have scorched more than 21,000 acres of forest and destroyed more than 50 houses. If the weather cooperates, officials have said they could have the High Meadow Fire contained by Wednesday. They hope to contain the Bobcat Gulch Fire sometime today. In stocks today, the Dow Jones Industrials gained 108 points or 1% to close at 10,557 in moderate trading. The NASDAQ Composite Index gained 129 points or 3.3% to close at 3,989. This is NPR News. The Supreme Court ruled today that states must follow federal foreign policy when it comes to doing business with companies that are involved in foreign trade. The decision throws out a Massachusetts law that limited the state's purchases from companies that do business in Burma. Attorneys for the state argued that Massachusetts has a right to apply a moral standard to its spending decisions and could withhold business from Burma, whose military rulers have killed thousands of dissidents. The Massachusetts law was challenged by an industry group called the National Foreign Trade Council, which said the law interfered with the federal government's authority to conduct foreign policy. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan toured the Lebanese side of the Israel-Lebanon border today amid a controversy over the demarcation line. Kate Seeley reports from Beirut.
Annan's trip follows a decision yesterday by the UN Security Council to accept as complete Israel's May 24th troop pullout from southern Lebanon. But Lebanese President Emil Lahoud disputes the finding. After talks with Annan, Lahoud said Israel continues to occupy parts of Lebanon's border area. There's concern that if Lebanon does not accept verification of Israel's withdrawal, it may block deployment of UN peacekeeping troops to the region. Nevertheless, Annan said he expects 1,000 UN troops to join those already in Lebanon by July. Peacekeepers would then move into the area vacated by Israel, filling the security vacuum left by its withdrawal. For NPR News, this is Kate Seeley in Beirut.
Police in Britain are investigating an immigrant smuggling operation after 58 people were found dead in the back of a sealed tractor trailer in the English Channel port of Dover. Police are keeping two survivors hidden. This is NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing soy and a variety of soy products to consumers around the world. ADM Supermarket to the world. On the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new movie Chicken Run is a satire of prisoner of war movies like The Great Escape and Stalag 17. But the prisoners are chickens, and the prison camp is a barbed wire British egg farm. My guests are the two animators who co-created and co-directed the film. Nick Park is a three-time Academy Award winner who is best known for his animated film shorts starring the characters of Wallace and Gromit. Peter Lord is the co-founder and chairman of the Aardman Studio in England, which specializes in clay animation. Park has worked with Lord at Aardman since 1985. When Chicken Run begins, the chickens are feeling defeated because their attempts at escape have all been foiled. But the heroine hen of the movie, Ginger, refuses to give up. She pins her hopes on the know-how of a free-spirited American rooster who has accidentally wound up at the farm. The rooster, Rocky, is voiced by Mel Gibson. Escaping becomes a necessity when the mean-spirited woman who owns the egg farm decides it would be more lucrative if instead of selling eggs, she made chicken pot pies. So she gets a diabolical-looking pie machine and explains her plan to her nasty but dim-witted husband.
Ooh, that's champion, that is. What is it?
It's a pie machine, you idiot. Chickens go in, pies come out.
Ooh, what kind of pies?
Apple.
My favorite.
Chicken pies, you great lummox. Imagine it. In less than a fortnight, every grocer's in the county will be stocked with box upon box of Mrs. Tweedy's homemade chicken pies.
Just Mrs.?
Woman's touch makes the public feel more comfortable.
Oh, right. How does it work?
Get me a chicken and I'll show you.
Nick Park, when did you start making the connection between chicken farms and World War II prisoner of war camps?
Well, the idea goes back to about 1996, when Pete and I were sat around drinking coffee. We were trying to think up a good idea for a feature film. And it just struck us one day, and this drawing just seemed to appear in my sketchbook, which was a chicken digging its way with a spoon out of a chicken coop. And Pete and I just thought, what a great idea for a movie. You know, it's The Great Escape with chickens. If you look at a movie like The Great Escape, which Pete and I were brought up on, you know, it was on every holiday, you know, with The Sound of Music and The Wizard of Oz. And if you were so familiar with that world of cabins and fences and barbed wire, and if you take the people out and put chickens in, you've got a chicken coop, a regular chicken coop.
Peter, were there certain stock characters you knew you needed to have when you decided to make this movie?
Well, in a way, there were. Our first instinct was to think, so who do you have in prisoner of war movies and copy that? To be honest, we went away from that very much. I mean, we have now the two rats who are scroungers, a bit like James Garner in The Great Escape. They were sort of stock type. But the others, I think, actually owe more to perhaps Ealing comedies, perhaps to English comedy films, English sitcoms, if you like, in a general way, rather than being specifically prisoner of war stock types. I mean, we wanted, for our own amusement and for the delight of the audience, we wanted to refer to specifically to Steve McQueen in The Great Escape, but we don't have a Steve McQueen character. We actually have a number of characters playing parts of that role, playing around with that role. So we certainly weren't rigidly sticking to it. In fact, like Nick was saying, that was our funny idea. And when we went to Hollywood, that was our funny pitch. You know, we would sit down with the big executives and say, and here's the pitch, gentlemen. It's going to be The Great Escape, but with chickens. But ultimately, that isn't what we've done at all, actually. It's nothing like The Great Escape.
Did you visit chicken farms?
We did. We were going to spend, you know, 3 months living with chickens to, you know, to really do it right. But
this is the method approach to understanding chickens.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And we actually ended up spending a day on a chicken farm. And we took a video camera with us and really got down on our knees with the chickens just to see what life is like from a chicken's point of view.
What did you notice that surprised you when you got down to a chicken eye level?
Notice they twitched a lot. The thing about chickens, which we hadn't reckoned on, is that their heads twitch fiercely and convulsively the whole time. You know, and because their eyes are on the other side of their head, they're constantly moving their head around to see things. And we very rapidly reckoned this would make for a terrible movie because you couldn't have a tender love scene because the two protagonists, would instead of looking into each other's eyes, would be twitching their heads the whole time. You know, to look out first one eye, then the other.
Yeah, in fact, we threw out, you know, what everybody knows as a chicken design quite early on in the film. So we had the knees bending the right way, and you know, we gave them hands instead of wings, and you know, generally improved, you know, what we know as a chicken.
Yeah.
Well, tell us what you did model the chickens on, the bodies, the heads, the eyes, mouth.
Well, you know, our chickens are such a daft group of characters that we wanted a lot of comedy out of them, and you know, like the Wallace and Gromit films, we gave them big wide mouths with lots of teeth and eyes that are touching in the middle, and it gives them a very funny kind of, you know, goofy and often deadpan look, which we play off a lot in the movie. And their bodies, we wanted to get a lot of mileage out of them being this group of very unathletic, you know, unheroic group that have never really done anything or questioned anything in their lives, and pulling off this enormous, enormous stunt.
Now, how did you give each chicken a distinctive look so we can recognize one character from another?
That was the difficulty, actually, wasn't it? Because you go to a chicken farm and they all look the same. They're all either all brown or all white.
Yes. So we made ours multicolored, didn't we? I mean, we have a rather nice color palette. You know, it's not too extreme. They're between very very pale and sort of chestnut brown and red in between. But they're a very harmonious group. And then we had to muck around quite substantially. And those strange combs that chickens have on their heads became like hairdos, and we played around with those a lot. And then, as a practical necessity of interest to people interested in the production, they had to have something around their necks because their heads had to join their bodies, and the join was between one material and another. The heads were clay and the bodies were silicon. So they all ended up wearing necklaces and scarves and other strange things, which, frankly, chickens don't normally wear, to be honest. But the great joke is that none of the humans seem to notice this at all.
Well, Peter Lord, you co-founded Aardman Studios, the animation studio that this film comes out of, and you're chairman of that company. Describe the style of animation in your studio that's used in Chicken Run.
Yeah, okay. Well, people call it clay animation. In the States, they certainly do. In Britain, we refer to plasticine, which is the trade name for the clay that we use. And plasticine is a sort of modelling material that kids use at a very young age, like in kindergarten. A clay that never hardens, always stays flexible. And we discovered this material sort of 28 years ago, I believe it was. And with my partner, Dave Sproxton, we started experimenting in this form of animation. And what it is, how can I describe it? With plasticine animation, with puppet animation, you have a puppet on a stage in front of a camera, like a regular film studio, but instead of the camera running at real speed, it just takes one frame at a time, and each frame it takes is effectively 1/24th of a second of finished film. So the puppet sits there, you bend it, you take a frame. You bend it, you get out of the way, you take a frame. You come back, you bend it, you get out of the way, you take a frame. And in this agonizing manner, you slowly build up movement. And that's how the puppet moves. And that's the mechanics of what we do. And that's actually quite boring. You know, that's the mechanics. The interesting part, the exciting part, is how you take that puppet and make it not just move, but appear to live. You know, the whole thing, animation, that's what the word means. It means, you know, having life, giving life. And that's what we're always, always trying to do. And over the years, we've gradually specialised in character and in comedy, I suppose, those two things that we like to do. And I know lots of people, most animation, you might say, is about comedy, but for us, it's very important that the comedy that we do use and we do play with is derived from believable characters.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Nick Park and Peter Lord, co-directors of the new animated film Chicken Run, which is about chickens in an egg farm, trapped in an egg farm, kind of like it was a World War II prisoner of war movie. And Peter Lord founded the animation studio that made the movie, and Nick Park is very famous for his Wallace and Gromit animated films. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Peter Lord and Nick Park. They're co-directors of the new animated film Chicken Run, which is a comedy about chickens trapped in an egg farm surrounded by barbed wire, and it's played as if it were a World War II prisoner of war movie. And Nick Park also made the Wallace and Gromit animated short films, which have won several Academy Awards. Let's talk about facial expressions, because I think that's the most communicative part of a body and probably a very difficult thing to put across in the kind of animation that you do, but you both do it so well. Maybe you could describe a little bit how you would express an emotion in clay animation, like confusion. You know, take one of the chickens that had to be confused at some point.
If you were to see the whole head of Rocky, it's only 2 inches high, and the space above his eyeball, and that space is, I don't know what, you know, couple of millimeters, but and it's with that tiny space that we play, and you can obviously make the brow frown by bringing it down in the middle. You can make a quizzical look by raising one side and lowering the other, and you can then make the eyes suddenly sort of, as it were, pop out of the head, suddenly get very wide. So you're playing with this brow, which acts like eyebrows, the eyeballs and the eyelids, and you can use lids to blink in different ways and indicate, you know, I don't know, complacency, and make the eyes smile. But you're talking about a tiny little canvas. And really, if you do as we've often done, you watch actors, watch a live-action movie and turn down the sound and see how the face acts. And it's frighteningly minimalist, you know, but it's those little signals that real people can give off very easily because they're real. We're trying to give those same signals in our puppets.
So you do this a lot. You watch movies with the sound off and just study the face.
Well, for this film, to try and get these expressions we've talked about, in practice, we talked to the animators at huge length about what we wanted and about the motivation for this scene. And often, especially at the start of the shoot, Nick or I would end up rehearsing a gesture 30 times, just over and over again, to try and sort of somehow communicate it to the animator. And after a while, we thought, well, this is a mug's game. This is really slow. So we started to record ourselves on video. So that would be us with the sound down. We'd look at our own faces, mute, and see, you know, yes, how you talk about bewilderment. How does bewilderment show on the face? What are the brows doing? How wide are the eyes? How are the eyeballs shifting around? Because that's another great indicator. It's where the where the focus of the eyes is really crucial. Are they focused right on the person you're talking to? Are they drifting around the room looking at other details? You know, all this kind of thing.
You know, one of the things I really like about your animations is that let me just explain. You're working on this teeny tiny little set. You've got the clay figures that you're moving around in these small increments. And in the set with them, you have a mix of like little miniature objects you've designed, like little miniature like chairs and houses and beds and things like that. But there's also a few real things. Like, for instance, there's a scene where a chicken is trying to tunnel out of the chicken farm with a spoon. And I suspect that the spoon is real because it certainly looks real. And so you have this mix of something that is absolutely real and something that's absolutely fantasy inhabiting the same reality at the same time. And it makes for very interesting viewing.
That's what we always find interesting about it, really.
That juxtaposition of the real and the imaginary?
In the same
reality.
Yeah, because that's right. I mean, we are what the world we've created is a strange sort of twilight world between kind of real live action movie making, because you've got a 3D set but in miniature. You can light it, do camera work, just as in any live action picture. At the same time, the characters, because they're made of clay, they can change shape and they can be very cartoony. And so we're always just traveling this very thin line between how real, how gritty, and how smooth and how soft is this world?
Because there's a huge difference as well, really fundamentally, between that room you've described. The bunk is made of wood, and you can see the texture of the wood. The bed has got straw in it, and you can see the texture of the straw. There's a piece of rusty old iron, you can see the rust. But then the chickens, our heroes, are these very, frankly, very cartoony constructs that look like clay. And intellectually, you'd never think that would work, I don't think. I think intellectually you'd say, that's crazy, that won't match, you know. But somehow it works, you know, supremely well, and you really believe the plasticine chickens in the real world. And that, again, that's just experience has proved that.
As we were describing, you work in these miniature sets for your animations. What does it do to your sense of size and proportion to spend your time in this teeny tiny miniature world?
Well, our sense of proportion went right out the window a long time ago. Otherwise, we'd be in some sensible occupation, I'm sure. I don't know. It's a very strange thing. For example, our chickens are 10 inches high, our model chickens, which is getting on for perhaps slightly more than half the size of a real chicken. So, relatively speaking, these are quite a big scale, because we're working to a half-scale thing. Imagine a chicken 10 inches high. Imagine a human comes into shot. The human ought to be, by that reckoning, about 3.5 feet high. And it's virtually impossible and certainly agonizingly horrible to work with an animated puppet 3.5 feet high, because animation ought to be hands-on and light and instinctive. And if the puppet's that high, you end up struggling with this massive engineering beast. It's really hard to bend. So we didn't do that. We made humans that were only 12 or 14 inches high, and miniature chickens, extra small chickens to go with the humans. So we ended up on two scales, which was one of the many things we stupidly didn't see coming when we stupidly decided to make a film about chickens, which we regard as our first mistake.
It's so funny that you're doing this very sophisticated kind of animation with this kind of comparatively unsophisticated style of animation, really literally moving around clay puppets. At the same time, that the big animation is the computer animation that everybody seems to be using now. Do you feel like you're living in another world than the computer animated people? Do you feel like you're in just another dimension altogether?
People often ask us about this, understandably, because with dinosaurs out right now, computer animation is very visible. And I mean, our attitude is always very simply, well, why can't the two coexist? You know, why on earth should the new technology push out the old if the old works. You know, why should a synthesized instrument replace an acoustic instrument? Why should it? No, it obviously, evidently shouldn't. The two, in a sensible, sane world, the two will coexist. So I hope that will always be the case. Having said that, it is kind of ridiculous. I mean, our technology is quite so old-fashioned, you know. But heaven knows it works. And also, you know, because it's hands-on, which it is, because it is, it consists of animators in studios handling clay models, and because also, strangely enough, strangely to your listeners, it's like a live performance. And that may sound crazy because everyone always talks about, you know, the words agonizing and painstaking are always on our lips. It is a slow process, but it's a live process because you've got your puppet, and your puppet is going to walk across the set from point A to point B. When that puppet sets off in the morning, you have no real way of knowing where it's going to go to. You know, you guess, of course, you approximate, you rehearse, but you don't know exactly. And when you're halfway across the set, you still don't know precisely where you're going, and you don't know, and you certainly can't go back, just as in real life. You know, you're a performer on the stage. You start the performance, you don't know exactly where you're going, and you sure as hell can't change what you've already done. And in that sense, what we do is live, whereas computer animation and conventional cell animation isn't like that, because you can do the last drawing at the same time as the first drawing and then fill in the spaces in between. Or, if it's not going well, you can easily revise it. We can't easily revise what we do. The only thing we can do is shoot it again.
Yeah. Peter Lord and Nick Park co-directed the new animated film Chicken Run. They'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Here's the theme from The Great Escape.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Saab, introducing the new performance lineup, the 9.5 Arrow and the 9.3 Viggen. Information available at saabusa.com and 1-800-SAAB-USA. From eTapestry.com, creator of web-based fundraising software for managing the donor information of large, medium, and small nonprofits, eTapestry.com. And from Random House Inc.'s Bantam Books Division, publisher of After the Ecstasy, The Laundry, How the Heart Grows Wise on the Spiritual Path by Jack Kornfield. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Kevin Whitehead reviews a new collection of jazz performances from classic films. We're listening to a track from it now. David Bianculli reviews two popular British TV shows that have made their way to the U.S. And we continue our conversation with animators Nick Park and Peter Lord about their new film, Chicken Run.
Ha ha ha!
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Nick Park and Peter Lord. They co-created and co-directed the new animated film Chicken Run. Park also created the Wallace and Gromit animated films. Chicken Run is a satire of prisoner of war movies in which chickens try to escape a barbed wire egg farm that is being converted into a chicken pot pie factory. Now, I have a confession to make. After seeing your movie and empathizing with these poor chickens, I ate a chicken dinner. Did I do the wrong thing?
Boy, what kind of movie is this? Obviously, it had no effect at all.
Did you find yourself shying away from eating chicken while you were making this?
No, actually, no. Rather the opposite. Our appetites were increased very healthily.
We were vegetarians before. But...
Yeah. No, it is odd. No, I mean, Nick and I don't personally. We were on a plane yesterday. We both ordered the chicken. You know, we don't feel it at all, I have to say. But I thought maybe we were desensitized, whereas you, as a fresh viewer, might have the decency to hold off for a day at least.
I guess not. I guess the movie just wasn't powerful enough.
Yeah.
Or I'm just too insensitive. Well, Nick Park, I have a question for you. Now, the new movie, Chicken Run. Chicken Run has a chicken pot pie machine, this insidious machine that the two mean-spirited humans have to bake these chickens into pot pies. And it's a bizarre contraption designed to take a whole chicken and mix it in with the chopped-up peas and carrots and dough and spit them out the other end as a pot pie. And our hero and heroine have to escape their pot pie fate and get out of one of these machines. Now, Nick Park, most of your animations have bizarre contraptions of one sort or another in them. In fact, before I ask you the actual question, why don't you describe a couple of contraptions from your Wallace and Gromit movies?
Right. What from? You mean a close shave?
Sure.
There's the wrong trousers, which are ex-NASA, in fact, that are actually bought from an ex-NASA store in Wallace's neighborhood. And Wallace uses them to they're covered in rivets. They're very round and robust and have a sort of 1940s feel. And I guess same too with the Knitomatic machine in A Close Shave. That's all covered in copper sheeting and rivets and that kind of thing. And lots of arms and lots of Jules Verne, H.G. Wells, and Victorian technology. I like to. Describe it as.
Yeah, and like the Knitomatic, you put a whole sheep in one end of the machine and out comes yarn, and by the end of the machine, I think a little sweater is coming out. These bizarre contraptions. Now, your father was an inventor. Did he make contraptions?
Well, he wasn't. I don't think I would describe him as an inventor, but he did make a lot of things. He spent his time in the shed making things.
What kinds of things?
Well, a lot of household things, just shelves, that kind of thing.
Made that caravan. Did you make a caravan?
Oh, that's right, yes. That's what made, after making the first Wallace and Gromit film, A Grand Day Out, I realised one day, he's so much like Wallace, because I recall this childhood experience where my father built a trailer, from scratch. It was like just a room on wheels, like a living room on wheels, and with beds inside, and made everything, and wallpapered it with furniture, and it had furniture and chairs and all that kind of thing. And the whole family, seven of us, went on holiday in this caravan.
Were you taken to any unusual factories when you were a kid?
Oh, yeah. Boy, I had this terrible experience of going to a chicken slaughterhouse. When I was a kid. I was actually a student at the time. I was doing a summer job, and I was working at a chicken packing factory, folding up plucked chickens and putting them onto trays and feeding them into this great big machine that wrapped them for the supermarket. And actually, one day I was sent down to the slaughterhouse because they were short of labour there, and saw some pretty horrific things there. And some of those ideas from both those experiences have actually come through and been used in Chicken Run.
Your characters of Wallace and Gromit, which are so popular now, Tell us if you kind of patterned them on anyone you knew, either in real life or in the movies. And I should say Wallace is a man who's a British man who's very stuffy and proper sounding, but in reality he's really not very bright. Gromit is his dog, and the dog is the smart one who reads books like The Republic by Pluto. So who's behind these characters?
Boy, I mean, I don't think I ever really consciously based them on anybody particularly. Wallace, perhaps, you know, when I think about it, you know, for reasons that I've given, he is very close to my dad, who, you know, he was like an inventor and made things. But I think it's his attitude, actually, the way he'll just get ideas and go about doing them without thinking. And he'll be, my dad isn't insensitive, but Wallace is very insensitive another influence, actually, he's very much like an old music hall character that's very much known in Britain, in the north, comes from the north of England, who plays a banjo, ukulele, and called George Formby. And he was very popular, I think, before the Second World War. And he's got a very similar accent and very similar attitude to Wallace.
Mm-hmm.
But again, it wasn't very conscious. You know, to base him, he isn't based on him, but I think these influences have found themselves in Wallace.
Did you have pets as a kid? Did you have a dog?
I never ever had a dog. Funny you should say that, though. We had a pet chicken.
Did you really?
It was our family dog.
Why did you have a pet chicken?
It was my sister's, actually. It was called Penny, this great big Rhode Island Red, and we just had it for the eggs, really. And it used to come in the porch, and we used to throw sticks for it and things like that. Never went and fetched them, but it was very much a pet. And we saw, my sister and I saw such character in that chicken. And we used to write short stories about this chicken, and one or two ideas have actually found themselves in Chicken Run, like Rocky being known as the Lone Free Ranger. But that was a joke we had as a kid.
Oh, really? That's funny.
Yeah, but we never had a dog.
Huh. Did you always want to make cartoons when you were young? Did you see those old cartoons and thought, I want to do that too?
Yeah. I just watched everything and took it all in. I had no idea how they were made, and so they always had an intrigue and a mystery to me. And I remember actually seeing a documentary about Walt Disney and how the whole thing started, with this little drawing of a mouse. And I used to doodle characters in my books at school and stuff, and I used to secretly dream that one day my characters would be known on the screen. In fact, I remember the first time I met Pete was at a film festival, and Peter's actually created this character called Morph, who's very big in Britain. He's like the British equivalent of Gumby, and he metamorphosizes into different things. And when I first met Pete, he had a badge on his lapel with Morph on it. And I just thought, how cool is that, having a badge that you can buy in the shops of your own character? I thought, wow.
Right, yeah, it's like something in your mind becoming a reality, this totally imaginary thing becoming a reality for so many people. At the end of Wallace and Gromit films, at least at the end of a couple of them, Wallace always yearns for some cheese. Mm-hmm. So why don't we end our interview with finding out about cheese? Why, why does Wallace want cheese?
Well, how do ideas come about? I think the single reason there's cheese, because it all starts when Wallace and Gromit go to the moon to find cheese, and I was trying to think of a reason why they would go to the moon. And then, you know, we record the voices first, and I recorded with Peter Salis, the actor who plays Wallace. It's just the way he said, "Cheese, Gromit," and that made such a nice mouth shape for Wallace. It was such a nice thing to have him get his chops around that cheese stuck, and it appeared in all the other movies. In fact, there's a very short little story that there's a factory in the north of England that makes a type of cheese called Wensleydale cheese, and we made Wallace say Wensleydale one in the third film in a close shave, and just by doing that, it actually put the cheese factory was on its last legs and about to go into liquidation, and it put the cheese factory back in business.
Are you kidding?
And
that's funny.
The Wensleydale cheese factory.
Well, I want to thank you both so much.
Thank you. Great pleasure.
Thank you, Terry. Thank you.
Nick Park and Peter Lord co-directed the new animated film Chicken Run. Nick Park also created the Wallace and Gromit animated shorts. Here's the scene Park mentioned that saved the cheese factory. It's from the latest Wallace and Gromit film, A Close Shave. Wallace is talking to his lady friend, Wendoline Ramsbottom.
You're very kind.
Oh, why'd you come in? We were just about to have some cheese.
Oh, no, not cheese. Sorry, it brings me out in a rash. Can't stand the stuff.
Not even Wensleydale.
Got to be on our way. Come on, Preston. Goodbye. Chuck.
What's wrong with Wensleydale?
Coming up, jazz performances from classic films. This is Fresh Air. The first talking motion picture in 1927 was called The Jazz Singer. There was no jazz in it. Critic Kevin Whitehead says the relationship between jazz and the movies hasn't improved much since, even with such directors as John Cassavetes, Clint Eastwood, and Woody Allen giving jazz a shot. But if Hollywood rarely takes the music seriously, there has been a bit of good jazz in the movies, often made by musicians turning up briefly in non-jazz films. Kevin reviews a new anthology of hot music from the movies.
New York on Sunday, big city taking a nap. Slow down, it's Sunday, life's a ball, let it fall right in your lap.
In John Gregory Dunn's book, The Studio, about life at 20th Century Fox in the 1960s, there's a scene where a luckless director pitches a story to a producer. The pitch went something like, a temperamental Russian orchestra leader comes to New York to conduct a benefit concert for crippled children, but then the orchestra's quarantined and he wants to cancel, but wait, there's this ragtag bunch of student musicians maybe he could try. The conductor's against it, but the kids win him over, only there aren't enough of them. So he goes out to weird nightclubs and rounds up some jazz musicians. But then the quarantine is lifted and the conductor has to decide whether to use the ragtag students and jazz musicians or... Somehow, that story says way too much about jazz in the movies. It's rarely confronted head-on, more often used to provide a little comic relief, urban atmosphere, or late-night mood. Jazz-loving moviegoers have favorite films on the topic. Mine include 1941's Blues in the Night, we just heard Jimmy Lunsford in an outtake from the film, as well as the amiably absurd Gene Krupa story and Martin Scorsese's meditation on art versus entertainment, New York, New York. When even your top jazz films include guilty pleasures, you know Hollywood's done something wrong. That feeling is reinforced by a new 2-CD anthology of music dredged from Ted Turner's vaults. It's called Hollywood Swingin' Jazz, Hot Numbers from Classic MGM, Warner Brothers, and RKO Films, spanning the years 1934 to 66. Still, there is a lot of good stuff here.
Did you hear what the lady said?
Not exactly. What'd she say?
She said, I got a snap in my finger.
Yeah.
And a rhythm in my walk.
You don't tell me.
As the elephants say, living in a great big way.
Oh, get away from here. That's too much.
I got a handful of nothing.
What?
But I peep at it like a hawk.
Peep at nothing?
I'm doing okay, living in a great big way.
Tell me more, tell me more.
Listen here, sir. I'm the salt in the ocean.
Mm?
I'm the sun in the sky.
Mm-mm.
I'm a Franklin D. Roosevelt.
Not the president.
I'm $1 million, long as I've got snap in my finger.
I'll stop.
And a rhythm in my walk.
Get away from here.
I got the devil to pay. I'm living in a great big way.
Well, let me tell you something.
What is it?
Gotta snap my finger. Yeah, yeah.
Bill Bojangles Robinson and Thomas Fats Waller from 1935's Hooray for Love. The mini box, Hollywood Swingin' Jazz, includes music from full-length features and from a few shorts, notably the classic performance film Jammin' the Blues from 1944. Elsewhere, Duke Ellington and Count Basie turn up, the latter with a stripped-down octet from the soundtrack to Made in Paris. A castle of good singers appear, from the Mills Brothers and Louis Armstrong, to Hoagy Carmichael and Lena Horne, to Carmen McRae and Mel Torme. Those singers include the cat who brought more relaxed jazz feeling to the movies than any other screen star, Bing Crosby. This standout is from 1956's High Society.
Dear gentlefolk of Newport, or maybe I should say hats and cats, I want you to lend an ear because, I want you to hear some really shimmering sharps and flats. For these cozy virtuosi, just about the greatest in the trade, are fixing to show you now precisely how, or approximately, jazz music is made. Well, you take some skins, jazz begins, and you take a bass. Man, now we're getting someplace. Take a box, one that rocks. Take a blue horn, New Orleans barn. Ah, you take a stick with a lick. Take a bone. Oh, hold the phone. Take a spot, cool and hot. Now you have jazz, 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 jazz. Little don't sound.
As much good and sometimes rare material this set contains, it could have been better. The booklet notes are long on capsule biographies of jazz greats and a little short on production anecdotes or discussion of how the music is used in specific films. The selections come off a bit arbitrary as well. We get two set pieces from Cabin in the Sky, but not Ethel Waters singing Happiness is a Thing Called Joe, which was written for the film. We get one good Pearl Bailey number from All the Fine Young Cannibals, but not Robert Wagner's classic bit where he demonstrates how he emotes on his trumpet. We get nine pieces from Andre Previn's score to The Subterraneans, far more than from any other film, but actually, that's okay. It features some of the West Coast jazz musicians who invaded studio orchestras in the 50s and 60s, resulting in more and better used jazz in Hollywood, if only temporarily. Well, with a set like this, you take your pleasures where you can and block out the rest, which is pretty much what jazz fans do at jazz movies already.
Hey, Pops, you want to grab a little of what's left here?
Yeah, Daddy, yeah.
Here we go. If you sail.
I sail in sailing.
Over the sea.
Or will you wait for me?
Take it
take my tip. They're all molded hip in Italy.
Well, Averiducci, as for France.
Oh, I know you'll never make this.
Yes, believe it or not.
I do believe, I do indeed.
The Frenchman's all prefer what they call leges high.
Fun me down, take a plane.
Oh, Baba do sat.
Go to Siam.
Baba.
In Bangkok today, round the clock, while well, they all like to jam. Indians
are
the Amazon. Beat one bar and all of them are.
Well, gone, man, gone.
From the equator up to the pole. Everybody winging, everybody singing that rock, 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 rock and roll. From the east to the west, from the coast to the coast. Jazz is king, jazz is the thing the folks dig. That's jazz.
Kevin Whitehead is the author of New Dutch Swing. He reviewed Hollywood Swing and Jazz on Rhino Records. Coming up, David Bianculli on British TV shows that have come to America. This is Fresh Air. In popular music, the most influential and popular British import was, of course, the Beatles, who hit America in the mid-60s. On Broadway, the British influence hit hard in the 80s with Cats and Phantom of the Opera, and continues to this day. And in television, as our TV critic David Bianculli points out, the influence from England has never been stronger than it is now.
This isn't the first time American television has borrowed heavily and successfully from the country we fought a revolution to escape. In the 60s, we imported Diana Rigg in The Avengers, Roger Moore in The Saint, and Patrick McGoohan in Secret Agent and The Prisoner. In the 70s, public television brought over Upstairs, Downstairs, which helped popularize and define the TV miniseries. Also in the 70s, Norman Lear adapted a British comedy about a bigot, Till Death Do Us Part, into one of the biggest and most influential American sitcoms of all time, All in the Family. Even with all that history, though, when it comes to British influence on American television, this is the true golden age. Start with Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, an Americanized version of the British quiz show. That's changed the face of U.S. television, at least for a while, and has encouraged the networks to take chances and try new forms. Then there's another popular ABC series, the improv comedy showcase Whose Line Is It Anyway?, also based on a British show. But look what's happening elsewhere. On cable, Comedy Central premieres an outlandish comedy series tonight called The League of Gentlemen, in which three very funny performers portray all the residents, some 60 of them, of a small rural English town. The series already has been shown in this country by BBC America, but since I'm the only person I know who gets that wonderful cable and satellite network, Comedy Central will get credit for giving most people their first taste of the best ensemble sketch series since Monty Python's Flying Circus and SCTV. Don't miss it. Tomorrow night, Comedy Central presents new episodes of the still-running original British version of Whose Line Is It Anyway? And where would PBS be without all the British imports on Masterpiece Theater and Mystery? Not to mention the somewhat inferior Americanized versions of Antiques Roadshow and Teletubbies. The best British import of all these days, though, is the 1900 House. It's a 4-hour documentary airing 1 hour a week on PBS, and it's absolutely fascinating. It's about a modern family living for 3 months in the manner and environment of a century ago. And the family moves into that home tonight, so tonight is the perfect time to tune in. Here's how the narrator sets up the premise at the start of tonight's show.
In an ordinary London suburb, an extraordinary experiment is about to begin. The mission, to discover how much domestic life has changed in the last 100 years. An average family has volunteered to give up the technology of today and live as Victorians. A time machine has been created. The address, 50 Elliscombe Road, Greenwich, England.
It sounds romantic and wonderful, but by the end of the third day, the poor wife has a mini nervous breakdown, the youngest kid is on a hunger strike, and the husband has ripped his face to shreds trying to use a straight razor. The 1900 house is loaded with history and social observations to make it worthy of PBS, but it's also addictively entertaining. And you can't help but identify with it and wonder how or if you'd cope under the same circumstances. From start to finish, it's the most striking and memorable British TV import since Emma Peel. And believe me, I can't give higher praise than that.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. The 1900 House airs on PBS stations tonight. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. I'm Terry Gross. I want to give you some advance notice that Mondays, beginning in July, we're going to rebroadcast our American Popular Song series, in which we profiled such songwriters as Hoagy Carmichael, Jerome Kern, Dorothy Fields, and Ubi Blake. The series begins Monday, July 3rd, with the music of Harry Warren, one of the most prolific Hollywood songwriters. His song Jeepers Creepers is featured on the Hollywood Swing and Jazz collection that Kevin Whitehead reviewed earlier. Here's Louis Armstrong from the 1938 film Going Places.
I don't care what the weatherman says. When the weatherman says it's raining, you'll never hear me complaining. I'm certain sunshine. I don't care how the weather vane points. When the weather vane points to gloomy, it's got to be sunny to me. When your eyes look into mine. Oh, jeepers, creepers, where'd you get those peepers? Jeepers, creepers, where'd you get those eyes? Oh gosh, all get up, I'd to get so lit up. Gosh, all get up, I'd to get that size. Oh golly gee, when you turn the heaters on, woe is me, got to put my cheetahs on. Jeepers, creepers, where'd you get those peepers? Oh, those weepers have hypnotized, yeah. Where'd you get those eyes, gate? Where'd you get those eyes, sash? Where'd you get those eyes? Papa, da dee da do 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 da yeah, there's eyes.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Alcatel, providing integrated voice and data networks for the Internet, enterprises, and carriers worldwide. At www.alcatel.com. From Lawyers.com, an online legal resource for identifying and hiring a lawyer. AOL keyword, Lawyers.com. And from Random House Inc.'s Bantam Books Division, publisher of Driving Myself Crazy, The Misadventures of a Novice Golfer by Jessica Maxwell. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Dr. Vioso Dobruna. She founded a clinic in Kosovo for women and children victimized by rape, torture, and psychological trauma. She's just received the Jonathan Mann Award for Global Health and Human Rights. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.